Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. American car company executives are taking comfort in a poll out today from the Associated Press. It says for the first time in years, slightly more Americans think American cars are better made than cars from Asia. That's, of course, fueled in part by Toyota's recent recall problems. But we're also hearing today that General Motors will invest $257 million in plants in Kansas and Michigan. And yesterday, GM said it would pay back some of its bailout money earlier than expected. Micheline Maynard is senior business correspondent for the New York Times. Mickey, start us off today by some of this car news. How would you assess it? You know, GM investing in plants, paying back some bailout money. Put that in perspective.
Well, Robin, to give you a little perspective on the bailout money, I don't want anyone to think that this is the entire $50 billion that General Motors got from the Treasury when it went through bankruptcy last year. This is a loan from Canada and the United States of about $8 billion. It was considered a loan and something that they had to pay back within 5 years. When General Motors left bankruptcy, they got about $16 billion in operating funds, thinking that, you know, the industry was in a slump and they would need the money to get back on its feet. Well, they haven't needed all the money, and so they've essentially paid back the U.S. and Canada with money that they were given to get back in business with.
And GM still isn't profitable. Neither is Chrysler. Chrysler posted a $197 million first quarter earnings loss today. So that sort of, you know, fills out the picture a little bit.
Yeah, but I think people are focusing at Chrysler on a $143 million operating loss they had in the first quarter. And that was on revenue of $9.7 billion. You know, with Chrysler, it's hard to tell because Chrysler was hit the hardest of the Detroit companies by the slump in car sales. And also, you have to think that Chrysler's about half the size that they were about 5 years ago. Remember back when they sold all those Jeeps and big pickup trucks and minivans? Well, now the market has turned away from vehicles like that, and Chrysler's remaking its lineup with some help from Fiat, which now has management control of Chrysler. So over the next couple of years, we'll see some Fiat-based models coming to the Chrysler lineup. And it was very interesting today. There was an analyst meeting, and the CEO of Chrysler and Fiat, Sergio Marchionne, was kind of critical of analysts who said, "You don't believe in this company." He said that Chrysler does have a future under Fiat.
Well, and what do you think? I mean, you say that the fact that Chrysler is half the size is kind of a good thing, you know, maybe leaner and meaner. But what do you think in general about American cars?
Yeah, I mean, I've been saying for a long time in a couple of books, actually, that I thought the American industry had to lean down in order to become prosperous again. And I do think there's hope for all of the Detroit car companies. You know, Ford has been able to restructure on its own without any federal money. Both GM and Chrysler did take bailouts from the Treasury Department. So we don't really know yet what's going to happen with them, but hopefully if what's going on with Ford is any indication, you can restructure and you can win back American buyers.
Well, we want to mention that executives at Ford say they haven't seen such a strong growth in their share of car sales since 1977 when Saturday Night Fever came out.
Well, that's an interesting way to put it, and I think one of the reasons is that Ford kind of hit bottom over the last couple of years, and now they are seeing market share growth. But, you know, given perspective, they had almost a quarter of the American car market at their peak, and now they have about 15%.
They can
come back, and they can be profitable, but it's not going to be the 1970s or even the 1980s all over again.
Well, and you've said you like the new GM leadership that's going to come in when the current vice chair, Bob Lupps, steps down soon. But over all of this is Toyota. Toyota is on track to pass GM in numbers of cars sold in the U.S., and it's being helped by these 0% financing deals. I know a Toyota dealer who says he's never done better, even with the scandal, because they've got these financing deals. And so I'm wondering, how do you see this playing out? Because if there's a sort of an incentive war going on, doesn't that ultimately hurt Toyota if they start getting into the incentive business instead of the values business?
That's absolutely right. And one of the reasons why people bought Toyotas over the years was that they thought they were buying a good value, a reliable vehicle, and they would pay a little bit more for it. In fact, When I bought my Prius, full disclosure, about 2 years ago, it was when gas prices were at $4 a gallon, and I paid the sticker price for that vehicle. So it kind of pains me a little bit to see the bargains that are available on Toyota vehicles right now. Last month, I think 71% of Toyotas were sold with 0% financing. That's double what it was in the peak month that they'd ever experienced. So I think what people are seeing is, you know, there's still good cars. They're still get good response from Consumer Reports, even though they've had the recalls that they've had. And so people see a bargain for something they still perceive as having value, and they're going to go out and get one.
So all told, Mickey Maynard, you got about half a minute. Are you saying that if we're taking the temperature of the American car industry, have we seen, you know, a slight improvement? Have we seen some good news?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's no question that the worst is over for Detroit. The worst seems to be over for other car makers, but nobody should expect the kind of rebound back to the sales we saw 10 years ago. It'll be a long, slow climb.
Mickey Maynard, senior business correspondent for The New York Times. Her many books include The End of Detroit, Collision Course, Inside the Battle for General Motors, The Global Manufacturing Vanguard. Check them all out. Mickey, Micheline, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Robin.
The Oscar-nominated film Food, Inc. gets its television debut tonight, broadcasting on PBS as part of the documentary series POV. The movie shocked viewers with its clear-eyed look at how the food we eat ends up on our plates. The not always, but too often, horrific conditions in which cows and chickens are raised. The business practices of industry tycoons like Purdue and Monsanto. Produced by Fast Food Nation author Eric Schlosser and featuring foodie icon Michael Pollan, the film also introduces us to people like organic farmer Joel Salatin.
I mean, a culture that just views a pig as a pile of protoplasmic inanimate structure to be manipulated by whatever creative design the human can foist on that critter will probably view individuals within its community and other cultures in the community of nations with the same type of disdain and disrespect and controlling type mentality.
Food, Inc. has been called the inconvenient truth about food with the same power as Al Gore's global warming film. But as The New York Times pointed out, Food, Inc. may also make you lose your genetically modified lunch. So a warning as we reprise our conversation with Food, Inc. director Robert Kenner.
It's really to get the viewer to start to think about where their food comes from. I think that our food has been transformed more in the last 30, 40, 50 years than in the previous 10,000.
Well, you illustrate how McDonald's started the fast food trend, and what grew around it was a fast food production line. Chickens, for instance, made you grow twice the size in 45 days instead of 3 months. But we hear from an industry person who says, yes, we're raising more animals on less land and we're feeding more people. What's the problem?
When I was a kid, food cost us something like 18% of our paycheck. Today, it costs 9% of our paycheck. When I was a kid, though, healthcare cost about 5% of our paycheck. Today, it costs about 18%. So in aggregate, the cost is going up. And I believe there's a direct link between healthcare and the food we're eating.
Well, you make that link with a family that you feature that can afford good food. A head of broccoli costs more than a soda and a bag of chips.
Yeah, and this family is now spending over $500 a month for medicines to combat diabetes. And that's with the father having diabetes, but it looks like their 13-year-old daughter will be contracting early onset diabetes, something that was unheard of a few years ago. It used to be adult onset diabetes. It's now become early onset because younger and younger people are getting this. One out of every three Americans will have early onset diabetes, Americans born after the year 2000. So on one hand, when you go to the, you know, supermarket, your bill is less than it used to be, but there are all these hidden costs.
Well, and your film lays out the case that snack food is cheaper than, say, an organic carrot because the government subsidizes big corn growers. So there's an excess of corn, and as a result, corn's in everything, including cow feed. But when cows eat corn, they're prone to E. coli. There have been deaths from E. coli, including a little boy in Wisconsin after he ate a tainted fast food hamburger. In your film, his mom, a Republican and now a food activist, lobbies Congress. Let's listen.
Really, our food safety advocacy work started 6 years ago when my 2.5-year-old son, Kevin, was stricken with E. coli 0157H7. and went from being perfectly healthy, beautiful little boy. And I have a small picture with me today that was taken 2 weeks before he got sick. He went from that to being dead in 12 days.
After her son Kevin died from eating a hamburger with E. coli, it turned out that the meat that killed her son stayed on the shelves for another 12 days because the government does not have the power to recall food that makes us sick.
Who has the power? The company?
Yeah, it's the companies. And I heard one of the heads of the FDA saying, you know, we think it's these corporations can police themselves better than the government can. And that's been sort of the attitude for the last 10, 20 years. Anyway, Barb, you know, after 8 years or so, Barb did not make any progress at getting government to be able to sort of take off tainted foods. It's not only meat, it's everything now. It's in all things.
Well, one of the reasons that there is more potential for disease and food is that cows, pigs, chickens are crowded together in these feeding areas on these factory farms, standing in their feces, dying in their feces. We've known this for a while. In the last couple of years, we've seen undercover footage of how these animals are treated. Sick cows, and you have them as well in your film, being prodded by machinery. Many Americans know this now. Why isn't there more of outcry over it?
There was an efficiency to this system. It's a false efficiency because it's an efficiency that's making us sick, and it's a system that's dependent on gasoline, and it's dependent on polluting the earth. And one of the things we do in Food Inc. is try to connect the dots to show that this system, if you look at it from the beginning to the end, it's not making sense. It solved a problem. It got us calories at much cheaper prices, but it sort of broke in other ways, and we have to figure out how to correct this system. For me, what's just as frightening and something that's probably not as well known is that we're being denied information about what's actually in our food. For me, that was the most shocking. We go to a hearing about whether we should be labeling cloned meats. I didn't even know there were cloned meats. But when the meat representative said, I think it's too confusing for the consumer to be given this kind of information, you know, I realized this kind of thing is happening over and over again for genetically modified organisms, whether it's for RBST, the growth hormone in the cattle. Time and again, these industries are trying to stop us from knowing what's in our food. And I think, you know, in America, if you have a great product, shouldn't you advertise it? Shouldn't we know? If you're going to have a free market, it's got to be based on information. And then we have the veggie libel laws, which makes it difficult to talk about this food. When I asked Barb, whose son died from that hamburger, what she eats today, she told me she couldn't answer because she could be sued. And then she reminded me about Oprah, who was sued for saying it makes you think twice about eating a hamburger during the Mad Cow incident.
And Oprah won her lawsuit, but she's got deep pockets.
And she also spent 6 years in court.
Just because she said that the Mad Cow scare made her think twice about eating hamburger.
Well, these veggie libel laws make it against the law to disparage a food product. If you endanger a corporation's profits, you're liable.
We're revisiting our conversation with Robert Kenner, director of the Oscar-nominated documentary film Food Inc., which in part depicts the horrendous conditions in which farm animals are raised. In one case, chicken farmer Carol Morrison, who then had a contract with Purdue, shows the camera crew around her chicken coop.
It is nasty in here. There's dust flying everywhere. There's feces everywhere. This isn't farming. This is just mass production, like an assembly line in a factory. When they grow from a chick, and in 7 weeks you've got a 5.5-pound chicken, their bones and their internal organs can't keep up with the rapid growth. A lot of these chickens here, they can take a few steps, and then they plop down. It's because they can't keep up with all the weight that they're carrying.
Chicken farmer Carol Morrison. At night, she says a huge garbage truck comes and scoops up the live chickens to take them to Purdue. Director Robert Kenner says farmers like Carol get into a cycle of debt because they're required to borrow so much money to work with the big companies, the little they get paid just doesn't cut it. And in fact, Carol lost her contract with Purdue because she refused to remove the windows of her coops and keep her chickens in darkness, which, as she told Robert, was just one of the many harsh practices Purdue required.
Yeah, ultimately, Carol's like, I think, third generation, what we call farmer, but it's really not farming, as she says, because ultimately, when you're growing these chickens, you have very little say over what happens. And It's part of a system that's abusive to people.
Which is why many of the workers, and you, this is another aspect of your film. I think the New York Times said you have about 10 films in one here. That's why there are so many illegal workers who do this work.
I think you can tell a lot about a society by how its food is grown. Our food is now grown by illegal immigrants. These are people who have very little say or no say, and that's why they're being hired, because these are dangerous, low-paid jobs. Even these illegal immigrants do not stick around to keep these jobs because they're just too dangerous.
But you show that some of these corporations advertise in Mexico for these workers. They know that they're there, and yet it's the workers who are getting thrown out of the country. The companies aren't being fined at all.
There's a real hypocrisy to our situation at the moment, because we have raids, and these raids are done with the cooperation of all the food giants. And what happens is the workers are arrested, but they manage to just arrest a few people each time so the lines don't slow down. So we continue to get our cheap food, but yet these people who are, you know, responsible for helping deliver this food are now put in prison. And we show a woman who's being arrested who'd been here for 20 years working on the line producing this food, who is now sent off to prison without her heart medication. She spends 1 year in prison and then is deported to Mexico.
Well, then there's Monsanto, the company, of course, that brought us Roundup, which kills weeds. But then in 1996, they began selling Roundup-ready soybeans. Only 20% in the U.S. at that time contained patented genes. By 2008, over 90% of soybeans were these genetically modified Monsanto beans. By law, Monsanto is allowed to require farmers to buy new seeds. Traditionally, farmers cleaned their old seeds and used them over and over again. Now they can't. Monsanto is actually able to go after farmers for violating patent laws if they clean the seeds and use them over again.
They have many lawyers who are going after farmers, and they're going after people who are actually even just cleaning the seeds.
It seems like they get you both ways. On the one hand, Monsanto requires that you can't reuse seeds. So if someone's cleaning a genetically modified a seed with Monsanto traits, they require you can't do that anymore. You have to buy a new one. So that's one. But two, since these genetically modified seeds blow all over the place, even if you're trying to have a farm without Monsanto seeds, they may have blown onto your farmland and Monsanto says, aha, copyright infringement, you're using our seeds without permission.
Yeah, in my mind, you'd think that would be trespassing. But and then the third is they're also putting the seed cleaner himself out of business. So if you don't have seed cleaners, even if you want to have a non-Monsanto product, you no longer have a chance to do it.
Well, here's Troy Rausch. He's the vice president of the American Corn Growers Association, talking about his own family's legal battle with Monsanto, trying to clean their seeds, trying to use their own seeds. Let's listen.
My family spent $400,000 fighting the battle pre-trial. And we were told it would take another $1 million to take the thing to trial. We settled out of court. The way the system appeared to work to me was Lady Justice had the scales, and you piled cash on the scales. And the one that piled the most cash on the scales and hired the most experts and the ones most willing to tell the biggest lies, that was the winner. That seems to be how our justice system functions now.
We used to have lots of scientific sort of investigation going on at our universities, at ag schools, and they were independent ways of researching how to create new crops. But that is now really generally all controlled by corporations such as Monsanto. So there's no independent research. So a lot of the studies that say that, you know, Monsanto seeds produce greater yields are basically funded by people who are being funded by Monsanto. It's very similar to the tobacco industry. You know, there were all those studies saying how cigarettes are not bad for you. And the parallel between these two industries is really important. These are really powerful corporations that are well connected to government. With tobacco, there was an incredible amount of misinformation about the safety of their product. And I think as Americans begin to understand the safety of this food system, I am very optimistic. And I really think of the film, you know, I hope it's very empowering that this is a system that can be changed. And we get to vote three times a day with breakfast, lunch, and dinner. We eat this stuff all the time. And ultimately, we're being denied information that's really essential to us as Americans.
That's Robert Kenner. His film is called Food, Inc. For more, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Robbie, thanks so much for coming in to talk to
us
about
it. Thanks so much, Robin.
The 50-year-old SETI, or Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Project, uses powerful telescopes and antennas to find radio signals and patterns that might mean intelligent life. But wait a minute, what if aliens have moved beyond radio signals? Some scientists think that projects like SETI aren't looking for life that's intelligent enough, that if we're looking for really advanced civilizations, we should look for signs of tomorrow's technologies, say pollution. Dick Carrigan is looking for alien life with the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory. Dr. Carrigan, explain why you don't think radio signals are the way to go.
The problem, in a sense, with radio is that you have to decide to do it, just like you decided today to do a broadcast. Mm-hmm. And somebody out there, if you will, has got to send a signal. And so what you'd really like to find, in a way, is things where people, aliens, little green men, have made something that left a message for the universe just by its presence. An interesting marker might be some sort of artificial contamination that crept into the atmosphere. A good illustration is freon, CFCs, I think some people call them. Freon was the stuff that used to be used in refrigerators in the bad old days. If you could find some artificial signature like this in the atmosphere of an exoplanet, planets around other stars, this might be a key of intelligent life there, or maybe dumb life that still had bad refrigerators.
I was going to say, because these are also known as chlorofluorocarbons, the CFCs.
You're better at it than I am.
Well, I've got it right in front of me. That's the only way I know. And it's one of the things that we know has led to global warming. And so a place where you find CFCs may mean that there's no civilization there that it once was.
That could be. The nice thing about that particular signature is maybe you could see it if you had a whole fleet of really big infrared telescopes 30 years from now or something, or 150 years from now.
Some other suggestions is that we look for the so-called Dyson spheres. Now, these are named after Freeman Dyson, who thought a future society would need to capture as much light as possible, so would build a shell around its central star, this so-called Dyson sphere.
To build a Dyson sphere is a heroic project. I mean, really heroic. You've got to go out and get the environmental impact statement done and permission to build, So, and this involves breaking up a planet, not something you just do in passing. And then you need the power out of the star for, let's say, 1,000 years. Again, if you're living in the solar system, to spend your resources like that is pretty ambitious. So I went ahead and I tried to look for these Dyson spheres with data from an old satellite. And I got three so-so candidates, but chances are very likely that they have natural explanations. We just don't yet have enough information about them.
So, Dr. Carrigan, what else would you suggest we look for?
One other atmospheric thing is changes like carbon dioxide. In the case of Earth, our carbon dioxide has risen by, let's say, 30% over 150 years. You could look for a change in the carbon dioxide at 35% and say, hey, somebody's doing something that's like people burning their forest and their reserves of fossil fuels.
The overarching point is we have to be like almost archaeologists in reverse. We have to, instead of, looking for the old ark, we have to almost look for something beyond even maybe our understanding right now.
That's an interesting way of putting it, because your point is that you don't know what the ark will be. Will it be that obelisk in 2001 there that you have no idea why it's why it's sitting wherever it is? It's going to be a hard look. I wouldn't bet against there being life. Would we find it? That would be a harder bet to take.
That's Dr. Dick Carrigan, an avid amateur astronomer and one of many scientists who says in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, we have to broaden our view. Thank you, and of course, you will call us first should you find anything.
Good to talk to you, Robin.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, your thoughts? You can always go to hearandnow.org. You can click on Contact Us or leave a comment right there on the homepage. By the way, you can also always find us on XM Public Radio and on Twitter at Here and Now. Pope Benedict making his first public comments on the clergy sex abuse crisis during his weekly public audience in St. Peter's Square, saying the Catholic Church would take action to confront the scandal. He also recounted his weekend meeting in Malta with eight men who were abused by priests when they were children in a church-run orphanage. The BBC's Vatican correspondent David Willey joins us from Rome. David, you've been watching this story for a long time, so what was the reaction today in the crowd?
Well, nothing very sensational. There was a bit of applause. Previously, he has been talking about it in rather veiled terms. The Pope does not seem to understand that this has caused immense scandal in many parts of the world. And the media reports, which have been coming from the United States, are now being augmented by other reports from many other parts of the world, which shows that this is indeed a worldwide scandal. The Pope, I think, has attended to address this so far in terms of the problem in Ireland, for example, or the problem in America. And when he saw at the weekend during his visit to Malta that this is really affecting Catholic opinion worldwide, I think he decided that it was the moment to say something. Of course, what we want to know, he was very short on detail, is what action actually he's going to take.
Well, and we wait to hear that, but you mentioned Ireland. The Pope did write a letter March 20th to the Catholics in Ireland, rebuking several bishops who were accused after a government-ordered investigation of abuse. And we're hearing today news on that front. We're hearing that those bishops may be resigning.
One extra bishop is going to resign. And, of course, yesterday we had the Pope is replacing the former Bishop of Miami in the United States, who was connected with an alleged cover-up of a paedophile priest scandal. The thing is that the Pope himself is perhaps the person best equipped in the whole Roman Catholic Church to know about the extent of these scandals, because for 24 years before he was elected Pope, he was in charge of the Department of the Vatican, which deals with grave offenses committed by priests. That's to say, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. And he was the author of directives telling bishops what they should do. There is a strong and a lingering suspicion that the Pope failed, at least in the early part of his time at the what was called the Holy Office, to appreciate the gravity of all this, and was not hard enough. Certainly the evidence in recent years is that the Pope has cracked down quite hard indeed when cases of clerical sexual abuse have been brought to his attention. But I think the dispute is really over the past. And, of course, interest has now shifted as to what he's going to do in the future.
Well, and you mentioned the past. I'm guessing the answer to this, but did he mention his role at all today?
No, basically these remarks were made in the context of a report to pilgrims gathered in St. Peter's Square of what a great welcome he had during his visit to Catholic Malta. He complimented the Maltese on the fact that they still don't have divorce or abortion. These are very divisive issues, and although the Pope feels very strongly that he has to maintain traditional Catholic teaching, this is not the opinion of many people in his flock, and this is the nub of the question.
Well, and that's showing up in surveys. We heard a BBC report this week from Germany that said a quarter of Catholics in Germany, Pope Benedict's home country, are at least thinking about leaving the faith. As we said, the Pope wrote that letter to Irish Catholics. He in some ways apologized for the bishops, but he did not mention church hierarchy. And the Irish reports concluded that this was a vast collusion on the part of bishops, sort of a church collusion to cover up abuse in Ireland. He hasn't at all, that we know, talked about the role of church hierarchy. Do you think that that's to come?
I would hope so. As far as Ireland is concerned, he's going to send the inspectors in to look at religious orders at seminaries and at in dioceses in Ireland, with instructions to report back to the Vatican and perhaps to propose a reorganization of the administration of the church in Ireland to ensure that there's a better control over to prevent a repetition of such scandals, which clearly damage the credibility and the reputation of the Roman Catholic Church all over the world. I think many Catholics are simply saying, what's going on?
So David Willey, last week the Vatican for the first time issued guidelines for bishops on telling them they should report cases of abuse of priests to police, but some are saying that they haven't gone as far as the zero tolerance policy adopted by the U.S. What do you think is next, briefly?
Well, I think the Vatican will come round to the thinking of the English bishops and of the American bishops, who have laid down very strong guidelines, and this seems to have worked both in the United States and in England and Wales, for example. But, of course, the thing is this policy going to be applied equally by the church all over the world? I think there's been a lot of fine words, but the Vatican certainly doesn't seem for a long time to have understood the extent to which these scandals in many countries have disturbed Catholic opinion.
The BBC's Vatican correspondent David Willey speaking to us from Rome. David, thank you so much.
Pleasure to talk to you.
A moment now to note a passing.
It's roots are in the sounds of the African, or should I say the mother, bringing us back again from the drumming on the Congo. It came with a strong flow.
The groundbreaking rap star Guru died this week at the age of 43 after a battle with cancer. His hit Jazz Thing was featured in the 1990 Spike Lee film Mo Better Blues.
Shouted on chain games, pain they felt, but it helped them to maintain. Scott Joplin's rags, Bessie Smith's blues.
Born Keith Elam in the Roxbury neighborhood of Boston, his father was the city's first black judge. His mom ran Boston's school library programs, and Guru began his career as a rapper in Brooklyn, forming the duo Gangstar. Here and now, pop culture critic Renee Graham says he was known for his expressive voice and will be remembered for infusing rap with jazz.
Sometimes Gangstar is overlooked, but true hip-hop heads know the value of that group and Guru's value in the history of hip-hop. Certainly one of the best rappers, right up there with Chuck D and Rakim, and one of the first to really make the link between hip-hop and jazz.
Guru Keith Elam died this week at 43. Back in a minute, here and now.
Great to dance to, great to romance to, with a lot to say to you. Relaying a message, revealing the essence of a jazz thing. In the 40s came bebop, the first bebop, the real bebop. So let me talk about Diz and Bird, giving the word, defining how a beat could be so complete. Playing with ferocity, thinking with velocity about ornithology or anthropology and even epistrophe. And this is real history, Thelonious Monk, a melodious thump. No mistakes were made with the notes he played his
consent. Mystery lovers rejoice. Rita Mae Brown and her cat and co-author Sneaky Pie Brown are back. Cat of the Century, the 19th and latest in their best-selling Mrs. Murphy mystery series, has just been released. Their heroine, a detective named Mary Minor Harrisdean, known as Harry, works, lives, and travels with her cats, Mrs. Murphy and Pewter, and a corgi named T-Tucker.
Harry rarely traveled without her friends. With few exceptions, their friendship meant the most to her in the world. For one thing, they never lied to her. For another thing, they didn't care if she wore jeans and cowboy boots, earrings and mascara, two nods to girly things. Fussing over her face and attire was just too much work for Harry. She had more important things to do.
That's Rita Mae Brown reading from Cat of the Century. And in this latest entry, Harry and her furry friends investigate a murder at a real-life Missouri college, William Woods University, which was founded for Civil War orphans and is a favorite of Rita Mae's. But they also spend time on their fictional farm in Crozet, Virginia. Rita Mae Brown joins us from Charlottesville, Virginia. Welcome.
Thanks.
There's one thing we have to address here. There may be listeners looking up at this moment saying, wait a minute. Isn't that the Rita Mae Brown who also wrote the groundbreaking 1973 lesbian coming-of-age novel Ruby Fruit Jungle? So let's just address that. How did that happen, a turn from such an explicitly lesbian coming-of-age story to a series about a heterosexual now-married detective?
Well, I think you can only come of age once, and then you've got to go on. And I mean, I suppose I could have written Daughter of Ruby Fruit Jungle all my life, but it would have destroyed me.
Well, did you ever think of making Harry gay, but just, you know, as sort of a sidebar, you know, nothing that would get dwelled on too much, just who the character is?
No. I don't find sexuality all that interesting. I find people's minds really interesting. And the bulk of the population is heterosexual and always will be.
Well, you've also been in the past a fiery activist. Let's tick through some. You were reportedly forced out of the University of Florida, some said, for being gay. You later said, no, you were fighting against race discrimination. You had a big, infamous dust-up with Now early on. Betty Friedan didn't want to deal with gay and class issues. You did.
I used to call him Now What? I torment him. But it was an organization for white middle-class women, and there's nothing wrong with that. Just say what you are.
Well, I'm wondering, too, that given these fiery moments in your past, I'm wondering if what this series, the mystery series, allows you to do, if it's sort of like literary knitting. You know, it's just so much fun.
It is fun. But, you know, as I've gone along in life, I've realized how much people suffer and the stress they're under. And if this series can just give them an hour or two's relief, I think perhaps I've done something right in the world.
Let's, for those who haven't read them, okay, the cat, Mrs. Murphy, prominent role. Your Tabby is your co-author, right in the back of the book. Why the cat? Cats, many cats. Why the animals? And they, by the way, have thought bubbles that humans can't hear.
When my mother was born in 1905, 90% of us lived in the country, 10% lived in cities. When I was born at the end of 1944, it was 50-50. Now it's 90% in the cities and suburbs and 10% in the country. We've turned our backs on nature with horrific results for other creatures as well as ourselves. And I love the fact that the animals, without being cute particularly, are able to voice their concerns. In real life, they actually have many more communication skills than we do.
Well, and the other part of what you were saying is that we're not connected to the land anymore. Your characters are. Harry and her husband are farmers. You also are living in the country, a working farmer, and you fox hunt.
Let me first say, American fox hunters chase. We don't kill. Don't confuse this with the
sure.
English. I do try to convey what it is like to live in the country, although I hasten to add, Harry is not me. She has some of my qualities, but she's not me at all. I think country life is a wonderful life. You're still in rhythm with the sun and with the seasons. I mean, I get up really early in the morning, and I try to knock some of the chores out before the heat comes up in the summer. And, of course, in the winter, you do the reverse. You want to go out when it's the warmest. I don't have to worry about cell phones or, in other words, what do I care? Well, I don't need a computer. I don't need any of it. All I need is the sun and the rain and good soil.
Is that giving up on the fight? For instance, I've been thinking, now I could be wrong, but have we not seen Rita Mae Brown in the front lines of the fight for gay marriage or equal rights? I mean, are you out of the fight now?
Those fights I am, yeah. So much of my energy now goes literally towards the earth. Because I don't care what rights you have. If you have no water to drink, you're dead.
Well, and some would say that is a right.
But we're going to ruin it. I mean, people are talking about global warming. What about the water table?
Hmm. Rita Mae Brown, it occurs to me that I had an experience in an interview that may be of interest to you. In the past, you had a relationship with tennis star Martina Navratilova. Now, this was before she was openly gay. And right about that time, I was substitute hosting on the Today Show. Now, she was scheduled on the show. The producers had made a deal with her publishers that she would not be asked about rumors about her sexuality. And then the day before the interview, an article appeared in the New York Times with speculation. Now, this was very awkward. The co-host wanted me to ask her. The producers didn't. It was live. And frankly, she seemed so frightened, so dear in the headlights that I did not ask. I know this all seems like, you know, ancient history, but your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are that cowardice is always corrosive and that all you have is your honor. And when you betray your honor, you have nothing. It doesn't matter how much money they give you. She was finally blasted out, said, well, yeah, I am. And the people are lionizing her for that, forgetting the years of cowardice. But that's okay. If she is able to give a child courage somewhere in the middle of Illinois, it doesn't really matter how she came out. She's out and she's there and people can see her. But I thought often the sickness of this oppression is such that gay people were the only people that can lie about who they really are. You can't lie about being a woman. You can't lie about being African-American or Hispanic or Asian. But you can lie and get away with this deep part of your identity. And the other thing I thought is, if a situation were reversed and heterosexuality was seen as sick, ill, evil, et cetera, et cetera, well, who would you see on the street? A heterosexual that could pass would pretend not to be. So you would see the dysfunctional people. You'd see the prostitutes and the pimps. And for decades, that's what you saw for gay people, the dysfunctional people. So coming out was actually the most revolutionary thing any individual could do.
So in effect, I'm hearing you say that one of the things you think about that time is, you say lie, other people might say just afraid, you know, of what would happen. But what it ended up doing was leaving people like you seeming like the only ones.
I was once the only lesbian in America, and I don't recommend it. It was cruel and brutal and all this and that. I lived through it. No matter how bad things were for me, it wasn't as bad as Okinawa. It wasn't as bad as Gettysburg. And I always knew that, and that's what drove me forward.
But it was rough.
Well, the other thing I used to think of at that time is, yeah, but they had comrades. I'm all alone, you know. But, you know, you do what you can. And there's a Southern saying, I can walk into my house justified. And I think it's one of the reasons I've always been so confident is that I didn't cave in. And I don't mean that I'm a hero. I'm not. I'm just not going to lie. Because how can you and I ever be friends if I am withholding a part of me? And ultimately, if you believe me, I'll begin to disdain you.
Yeah.
I want to be open to people. And if they don't like me, okay, they don't like me, but I tried.
That's Rita Mae Brown, still sounding like a gay rights activist, but as we said, now author of a series of mysteries, the latest Cat of the Century. She writes them with her cat, Sneaky Pie Brown. By the way, Sneaky Pie?
It's an old Southern expression. When, like, if I were to put one over on you, you might look at me if you were Southern and say, why, you old Sneaky Pie.
Rita Mae Brown, thank you so much.
Thank you, ma'am.